In the studio, I'd like to welcome Crystal Van Hout and Louis Galloway. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Last names this morning. It's very. I'm going professional now.
Golly gosh,
did you say
I feel
my last name.
Van Hout. Did I say it correctly? I didn't say it in the Dutch way.
It's actually Van Houten.
Yeah, but you're in New Zealand now, so you have to say it this way.
Because
yeah,
we have to butcher your name.
This is New Zealand, yeah. And we say names how we like, which I'm sure you're used to.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're here from the Cutio Project. We talk to Crystal regularly. We haven't talked to Louis before, although regular listeners will know Louis's voice, A, because he does a show on Monday nights at 6.
We always
the Fourth
listen.
World.
The Fourth World, but also because...
Crystal hates the music.
Louis did a jingle for us 10 years ago, and his voice has actually been on the station, one of the station jingles for a long time.
I forgot about that actually.
Yeah, well, I haven't because I hear it every day.
Yeah.
The Kauriu Project's all about. Well, it's a lot to do with birds. And Crystal, we just told Crystal the news that the Pūtekiteki won the Bird of the Century, and your comment was, "But it's an Australasian bird." Was that your comment? You weren't aware of what's been going on.
Oh no, I did have a brief look, but I was straight away like, I'm not. Choosing any bird that has Aussie in it, even if it is Australian.
Most birds in New Zealand originally came from Australia.
Yeah,
that's the funny
Louis.
Thing.
They blew over.
Yeah, pretty much.
But they've evolved a fair bit, though. Like all the parrots we've got, they don't look like Australian birds.
Yeah, they've got bigger and buttier. That's pretty much.
And kind of more humorous.
Yeah, weirder.
So, but the Pūtekiteki, I can see why John Oliver went for it. It looks kind of cool. And it vomits, apparently, so...
It's the mating courtship dance which really got him, I think.
Yeah. Mm. So, anyway, it won by... Well, actually, we don't know. They haven't counted up all the second votes, but last year they got 50,000 votes for the Bird of the Year award. This year they got 350,000, so...
It's cool. It's all good for birds. And that hairstyle, I reckon, is going to be the new trend.
Hairstyle,
I think you'd look good with that.
Go down
I've
to see,
booked my appointment.
We're going to go down and see Ray at the barbers and say, can we have a Pūtekiteki cut, please? That'd be cool. Yeah.
So, any hairdresser listening should get on it.
Totally. So let's talk about a bird that's relevant to the Kauriu Project, the poster child for the Kauriu Project, the oi, the grey-faced petrel. And we always start off with where is it at in its breeding cycle at the moment?
Yeah, we're coming up to the few weeks before fledging, which is exciting. But actually, we kind of have a little bit of sad news.
Oh,
yeah.
There usually is. Let's be honest.
Is. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough haul getting them through till December. So they're not doing that great this year. Like, we've seen a massive drop off and... We suspect we might only get about 5 or 6 chicks out this year.
Which is
compared to last year was our best year, and we had at least 12.
Yeah.
So it's quite a drop, and
there's some stoat incursions.
No,
or something.
No, that's the thing. We haven't.
And well, there was a ferret.
There was a ferret early on, so we do know we probably, but we didn't. We haven't captured a lot of other activity on our cameras, which is how we monitor. So, yeah, so we're not 100% sure, and we're kind of talking to other projects around the country as well.
Yeah.
There have been some discussions around, like, whether sea temperatures can affect food supply, but then the oi are pretty good at scavenging and shifting food source, like picking out different species so that, you know, they're more generalist rather than specific feeders. So
pays to be a generalist.
Yeah. So they have got, you know, but it can just happen. You know, we might have just had one of those years, and the great thing is they will be back next year and, you know, they will come back. And so if there's anything that's challenging for them or there's predators, parents might take off or not come back just to protect themselves.
Yeah, of course.
So as long as we're not losing the adults, it might just be a bad year.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's right. I mean, given the whole situation, you'd expect to have variation.
Yeah.
Year to year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cool news is that in other birds is that we've pretty much completed our bat map. And we've got bats all around our community and broader kind of the area around Kauriu especially.
In town?
Around town, not right in town. Some of the sites that we monitored in town didn't get a detection. Doesn't mean they're not there, but just not where
likely.
We had them. But we did have lots of locations around the mountain and in rural areas.
So this is the first time you've done a survey of bats?
It's the second time, and we'll probably do another one a little bit better. Like, there was a few little errors that we had this year, so we're probably going to do another really good round next year.
So can we tell what have we learned? Because you've done two. Do we know if there's population increase, decrease, or anything like that?
No, it's pretty hard to tell. Like, so it's more of a kind of presence, absence, but then you can also look at how many passes you get. So sites with high activity will have more passes, but it could be the same birds. But, you know, so there's not...
Same bats.
Oh,
well, that's
bats.
Actually controversial. Yeah, the, last year's controversy.
Oh, it was
bird of the year.
Bird of the year was a bat.
Yeah. Flying mammal.
It's a manu.
There were 40,000 votes discounted in the bird of the century. Like, this is the hilarious thing about
it. How many?
40,000. Because someone put 40,000 in that they weren't supposed to. One person even voted 40,000 times for the Tawaki Pikatoka, the eastern rockhopper penguin. It is a funny thing, but it's generating a lot of good.
Hopefully, it's money
and cash.
Yeah, hopefully, it's money for Forest and Bird. And
yeah, if 40,000 votes all came with a $10 donation, that would be something.
Actually,
yeah, that would be cool. I hope that comedian dude's going to make a big donation.
Well, there were 40 votes under his name, 45.
Mm.
So, well, he's probably done quite a lot. But we're getting sidetracked again. So the bats is it a healthy population of bats around here?
No, well, it's not. It's not a huge one, but the thing is that we now know they're here.
Yeah,
and it's a real encouragement, especially for our backyard trappers, because if you're trapping in your own backyard, you could have populations of bats roosting around your property, and you're protecting them. So it's a real boost just for just general bird life and mammal life in Raglan. So it's just another species that we can monitor, and then over the years we will be able to hopefully pick up more sites, and that's why we'll regularly monitor for them.
Cool. Shall we introduce Louis as a new member of the team?
Although yeah.
Not that new, Louis. How long have you been working for the Karigua project?
Been about 6 months now, I'd say.
6 months?
Six months?
Something like that.
And you are a ranger? Are we calling you a ranger? Ranger?
Yeah, Ranger Lou.
Ranger Lou?
Call me a ranger. Yes, that is my official job title.
Which involves, sometimes I'm messaging you about radio station stuff, and then you're like, okay, I have to stop now because I've got to climb up a steep part of the mountain.
Yeah.
So you're up there somewhere a lot of the time, are you?
Yeah, out in the bush up the mountain quite often, which is kind of a dream job, really. Yeah.
That's what you like?
Yeah, I like
prefer
just
trees to people.
Generally. That's why I do a radio show, because there's no one directly in front of me.
Yeah, it is weird like that if you notice someone listening.
Yeah.
Have you ever had someone come in and listen while you're on the air?
No, I just shut the door.
You shut the door, it's quite disconcerting, yeah. So are you just out setting traps and cleaning traps out and things like that? Is that what you do?
That's part of the job. It's a super varied job, though. We do bait operations, so I'm helping organise those, and we're doing coastal stuff, so we have some monitoring. I don't do a lot of the coastal stuff, but we do like monitoring of possum and rat numbers. What else do we do? Yeah.
I know. What else do you do, Louis?
What do I do?
Who wrote your job description?
It is pretty varied. It's anything from training and just fixing stuff and clearing out stuff. And
there is some education stuff every now and then as well, but it is primarily based around predator control. So that mainly involves trapping and bait station work, because we've got quite a extensive network of bait stations up on the mountain.
Yeah,
we've probably got we have over 100 kilometres of tracks. So that's bait stations and traps, and it requires heaps of maintenance, I think.
Actually, that's a big part
months,
of the job, yeah.
Big maintenance.
Just keeping the track, you got original, one of the earlier phases of the Karigua project was to cut trap lines through the mountain. Are they easy to see, Louis?
You get an eye in for it, so like I could probably follow a track a lot better than Joe Bloggs off the street, but that's kind of part of the goal, because we have a big volunteer group that kind of drives the project, so we kind of need to make it usable for them. So that's kind of that's our level of standard that we go for, is that someone off the street could come and, you know, well, we normally pair them up. Well, we always pair them up with someone who's experienced when they first go out.
Yeah.
But it should be easy enough for anyone to follow. Yeah.
So if people recognise Louis's name, Louis Galloway. Louis grew up here, went to school here, and yep. You've been doing other things in other parts of the world. Is this previous work you've been doing similar to this?
I've done a lot of things. I've kind of, in the last few years, focused back on conservation work.
Yeah.
So it was a passion when I was a child, but I also had sort of creative stuff in the mix, which was maybe a bit more of a compulsive thing, so it kind of took over. But yeah, I've kind of decided that now is the time in my life to really push myself back into the conservation world and do my bit that way. So it's been the last few years, I'd say, I've been working in conservation more seriously.
And I know, because I've been up on the mountain with you, and you know, like, you know the names of all the trees and plants and things like that, which was hilarious because you asked me if I could name anything, and we're near the top, so there was...
Yeah, sorry about that. I didn't mean to, you know, put you on the spot. I was
really
curious.
It was really interesting. Well, I was curious too to realize, because we were up high, there wasn't any of the plants that I would necessarily recognize. So I couldn't name anything.
Yeah.
Just slightly embarrassing. I'm not a like I'm wired for people kind of stuff, not environmental stuff.
It's a certain brain that, you know, I'm not amazing at the botanical names and everything, but some people like Lenny, who you've had on the show, he's very focused on that, and he's getting pretty good at the botanical names and things like that. So it's all relative. It's all levels of interest and, yeah.
So were you aware of the Karioi Project till you came back?
I've been aware of them since early on. I did volunteer, on a trap line a long time ago, but I've been sort of fairly itinerant, I moved on and that was that. But I've been aware of them I've been very interested in what's happening in conservation in Raglan, even though I haven't been around. So, I might not be a good indicator of the general Karioi Project reach, but I've been quite aware of them.
But I was just kind of curious because the project has grown. I mean, it kind of started with random people deciding they just wanted to put some traps up around the place.
Yeah, you're calling me random.
You're random, Crystal.
Were you one of the ones just heading up the mountains going, oh, I'm going to put some traps up there this week? Because I knew quite a few people who were just like, oh yeah, I'm just putting some traps up. This is my... Okay, so this is not the official history that I'm giving here. This is just like...
this is what it seemed like to you.
Yeah, that's right. This is what it seemed like
maybe
to me.
That
people were doing that.
It's interesting that you sort of realise the different varied interests that people have, and you don't know until you hear about what they're doing that they're interested in that.
Mm. Like, you know, Cunny, he used to go up there and do that.
Cunny?
Yeah. Like, that's one person I'm thinking of. But and then it gradually got more and more formalised, and... That's where, I guess, Arosho, you came from, Arosho, and kind of umbrellaed the project.
Yeah, we partnered with Te Whakaaronga o Karioi. So that was Malibu and John Wilson and Sandy Honoku. That's kind of where it formally came from. But you're right, like, there was people trapping possums, and then Thomas and, you know, a bunch of guys from the Hapu had traps, you know, and were doing trapping and possum hunting. For many years, you're right. But the formal part of the project came, probably much after that.
Actually, I think 2009? I think the Environment Centre was sort of involved as well.
Yeah, we always partner with the Environment Centre.
Because I remember some substantial funding came through, and it was like, right, now we can really get stuck into this.
Yeah. So we applied, because I couldn't apply through Arosho because of it was lotteries funding.
Oh, okay.
And
Arosho is a faith-based group, describe it that way? Yeah.
So at the time we couldn't apply, and that was when Bexy and Danielle and Michelle and all that were part of the Environment Centre, and Liz, of course, as well. So they just helped push through that first application. Yeah. So it's always been a real collaborative effort. It hasn't been about any one. You know, different people and different organisations have had different responsibilities.
Yeah.
But obviously now it's a bit more formalised. A lot of the management and HR and health and safety goes under our rosha because some, you know, when you're employing people, it has to go through someone. Someone's got to, you know, do the governance.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and there's quite, I mean, how many volunteers? You got like 100 volunteers?
Yeah, about 100 regular.
Well, there's a lot of management required now.
Yeah, yeah.
And how many staff? How many Louis?
how many Louis?
Only one me.
Yeah, there's only one.
There
Louis.
Is only one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Jasmine, our volunteer coordinator. A lot of people know her. And then at the moment, we've also got Terrence and Lenny. He's with us part-time because he's studying as well. And then we've got our education team.
Don't forget Isabel.
Oh, that's right. We've got Isabel. But Isabel's in Canada, but she's actually doing a chunk of work for us remotely.
That's where she's from originally, isn't it?
Yeah, so she's spending some time there with family. But she's our backyard hub coordinator. But, yeah, just doing heaps of work, just getting through a bunch of stuff that we haven't got to, like updating the website and all that kind of thing. So, and lots of operational stuff.
So, Louis, have you been also involved with the social enterprise side of it?
We've done. Well, recently we did a we helped out a local landowner set up their trap network, basically. So we took out a bunch of possum traps and rat traps, and located them around their little bush block that they had, and. They had really good results with that. I think you've got the...
Yeah, it says, because you guys put out a Facebook post, it says within a week they caught 23 rats and 15 possums.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's good to catch them, but it is a sign that they were kind of a little bit overrun?
Yeah, well, unless you do monitoring after the initial period, then it's hard to know whether your trapping network is... successful or your numbers are just high. You know what I mean? Like maybe the numbers will go down and that could be a sign of success, or it could be a sign that your traps are not working anymore. But I'd say that's just a sign of a lot of numbers there, yeah.
So what's that yellow thing stuck onto the side of a gate post or a fence post, sorry, corner post? Is that is the trap?
That's a possum trap, yeah. It's called a flipping Timmy. It's... It's one of the new generation of traps. Most people know the old Tim's traps, but this one's just a lot more convenient to use. And
so is it put on the... Possums like to climb trees. Is that why it's up the post? I mean, it's not very high. It's like waist high, but...
Yeah, I mean, it just positions them in the best way for a humane and efficient dispatch.
All this conservation work's pretty unsavory, isn't it?
It's not a pretty job. It's true,
yeah.
You know, like the truth of it is that we're carrying out a genocide on these poor rats and possums, but it's sort of, you just ask yourself, what would you rather see, you know?
Yeah.
And you see the difference, like we've, even on Kariyoi, there's areas that we're more actively managing and there's other areas that we haven't had so much access to and we're just now getting access, and you can see the difference in the... mainly in the plant life. A lot of their favourite trees, like kohikohi, you know, in those areas are quite hammered, and the bush is, the understory is not necessarily there. So you can see it and you can feel it when you're out there, the difference that it makes.
Yeah, yeah. And for the people's property that you did this recent trap line in, like what have they got on their property? What are they trying to protect?
It's a small block. It's really nice bush, but it's... Yeah. Sort of a tiny couple of tiny little pieces of bush surrounded by farmland, but it's really useful because those pieces of bush act as kind of corridors for movement of different birds and stuff, little refuges. So it's certainly important. If we could protect all those pieces of bush on farmland, it would make a big difference.
And how much, Crystal, how much trapping is there on the farms around the maunga?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because one of our biggest challenges is like maintaining those edges. So possums like to hang out in those bush grass edges.
Yeah.
And so we can do all the work we can on the mountain and get the numbers really low. So we've kind of tracking in areas where we have high intensity traps and bait stations. We're tracking about 7% for possums on our monitoring. But you could track 7% on the mountain and still have loads of possums on your edges. And also those little bush blocks, like those numbers show, 15 possums in 1 week, they just hold heaps of possums. And that's actually how our backyard hub started.
Yeah.
Because Nick, who started the backyard hub like as a team member for us, she was trapping in her own backyard just down from that property, and she was just catching possum after possum. And we just realized that, you know, if you've got 30 possums sitting in this little bush block around the mountain, it just becomes a restocking of possums from those little bush blocks onto the mountain. And so Regional Council does a big job going to some of those edges, like farms, yep, you know, around the mountain. But they don't go far enough for us to really be successful. So we kind of see our scope as being from Aotea Harbour to Whangaroa Harbour and all the way to the Divi. That's kind of like our kind of peninsula. We kind of see it as a peninsula.
To protect the mountain, you need to be that far.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the mountain. Yeah. And I have noticed, like, when you look on Google Maps and you can see the property boundaries, like, there's lots of private property around on the north face of the mountain down to the water.
And then
there's Upper Wainui Road, and there's lots of properties there also backing, lots of little properties backing onto bush. So would you like to get all of those involved?
We've already got, obviously, like, we've got about 450 households on the books that are trapping in town and around the mountain.
That's a lot.
But we're actually doing a bit of a research project in partnership with Land Care Research. And they are looking at kind of volunteers and backyard trappers and who's signed up and who's active, but also who signs up and isn't active. So it's going to be really interesting getting some kind of those volunteering results and seeing, like, what we can do to keep encouraging people to keep trapping, even when they get a trap.
Like, if they have a busy few months of their life, they might just leave the trap there.
Yeah, and that's why we provide services like this, which is kind of part of our social enterprise, is that a lot of people want a trap, and we've got, like, about half a dozen landowners that regularly get us to check their traps, and they pay us for it because they want to do the predator control. Often they're planting lots of native trees, and it's all very well planting the trees, but if you don't have the predator control in place, you're never going to be as successful, and it's never going to flourish in the same way. So you want them to go hand in hand, and so these landowners have come on board and gone, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it well.
So how does it work? Do you, like, every week or every fortnight or maybe every month someone goes out, like, someone like Louis goes and checks?
Yeah, so it kind of, at the moment, that's Lenny.
Yeah.
So for us it was social enterprise to try and generate some income for the project, but also create employment opportunities. And we've got these students that are graduating from our education programs who will, you know, some of them can get a job with us, and that's how Lenny came on board.
Yeah, and you've had others like Dayton.
Yeah, Dayton, and Liam. So we had about six students so far that have worked for us, and at the moment we've got Lenny.
And is it, I guess it's, as you kind of liken it to someone mowing your lawns for you.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
A lot of us can't be bothered mowing our lawns anymore and get someone else to come and work around.
Yeah.
And is it a similar cost? How much does it cost?
It depends on how many traps and where you are.
Yeah.
Like, some people pay, you know, quite a lot, but we're checking 50 traps for them.
Oh, wow.
So this is
on
a large scale.
Yeah, yeah.
And then other people, it might just be like $40 or $50 a week, you know, a fortnight.
Yeah.
A fortnight. And then, so it's kind of affordable, especially if you've got, like, people that have got houses here, like a Booker Batch type, you know, holiday houses. But then they'd come to us and report how rats were running through the house, which is not that pleasant for guests.
Yes, yeah.
And, like, you do get a lot of rats in houses here, and also people coming to us, like, getting their car wiring chewed out. Rats all chew through your walls and pipes and appliances. So it's not just for conservation, but also just for general house maintenance that you want to do it.
Yeah, that's a bit nuts.
Mm, yeah.
Louis, do you have a favourite pest?
Favourite pest?
Yeah, favourite pest. Sorry, this is a really silly question.
Well, I mean, the stoats are pretty incredible animals, super intelligent.
Right. In fact, that's a problem with a lot of these pests, isn't it? They're pretty smart.
Yeah, I mean, possums are on the lower scale of smartness.
Okay. Yeah.
But stoats are definitely up
you
there.
You got that ferret the other day, too.
And, yeah, that was we've sort of been trying to catch ferrets, and they're one of the more difficult ones to catch, especially after we had that incursion down in the Oi Burrows. So, but they have... Yeah, they all have very specific lifestyles and, you know, home ranges and ways they move through the landscape. And so, you know, you sort of have to become more of a hunter than just sort of checking traps.
Right.
Which, you know, I'm getting better at, but it's a long-term, you know.
When you say hunter, like how actively are you doing that?
Well, it's more just trying to understand where in the landscape they'll be and what paths they might travel, and getting to understand a bit more of their biology and psychology. I mean, you know, as much as you can.
Yeah, yeah, building knowledge. What would happen in this country? Like, I don't want to get into talking about 1080, but I'm just wondering what would happen into this country if we just did no protection for our native bush. Like, we know what happens in some places, like, you know, the undergrowth goes and then...
Yeah, I mean would it... The mountain would be pretty bare. It'd get more and more bare. Mm. You'd see a lot of dead trees up there.
Mm.
I mean, ultimately, would it all die out? Does it get that bad?
Well, it gets chewed out and the numbers go up and then, like, it strips, you know, like, especially their favourite trees, but then they just go on to the next thing. But they also go into burrows and get eggs and, you know, like, possums are actually kind of quite generalists. Yeah. They'll, you know, take whatever. But also then as you damage the trees, the wind gets into it more and that breaks down the trees. So you really lose your canopy. And, I mean, you probably remember looking up at the mountain, you see all the trees are quite stripped bare. Not all of them,
but certain ones,
I always remember seeing that. Like, and it's really good at the moment.
I do remember as a child seeing, being able to see dead trees up there.
Mm. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just regeneration. I mean, they go...
Would it completely destroy a forest? What would happen?
I mean, it'd probably become more like a monoculture, less diversity. There'd be the certain hardy ones that they just wouldn't eat.
But that wouldn't be good for native species either.
Mm. Well, no, I mean, that's their food source.
Yeah, that's the stuff they don't eat probably as well.
Yeah. And also certain birds are linked to, you know, tree forest regeneration, like kereru, you know, like with the pururi. And then, you know, like, so they eat the berries and then spread them. You know, so it's also the way birds, like seabirds, have come in from the sea. They gather nutrients from the sea and deposit them onto the land. So our coastal forests, and you can actually class most of New Zealand coastal forest because no forest is probably more than 100 k's from the coast. And we used to get seabirds all the way to Maungatauturi.
Yeah.
You know, those seabirds, and that they bring the guano, they bring the, you know, they fertilize the land, and there'd be hundreds, thousands of them coming into our coastal areas. Then they dig up and burrow the soil. So they kind of, we call them ecosystem engineers.
Yeah.
So it's not just the forest birds, it's how each bird is linked to the ecosystem and how it kind of completes the cycle. So you lose one and you lose so much, you know, and probably half the stuff we lose we don't even know.
And I think even like in terms of human society, like we're kind of living off the glory of the past with our soils, you know, in terms of bird life and the nutrient that we have in the soil. So much of that comes from the huge mass of birds that we had and the forest that was there. So, yeah, it's a very broad and complex picture.
Mm.
And by no means are we, like, pro-toxins at all. It's a means to an end is pretty much... Well, I mean, that's my personal feeling towards it. I'd rather not use it.
I have seen pictures of parts of native bush where the canopy's starting to be destroyed. And it's not a hopeful thing to look at. And I'm thinking of a farm I know where there were some unprotected native trees just left and the cattle could move through them.
Mm.
And over the years, they looked more and more like they were about to die. Like the trees looked older and haggard and there was just little bits of growth every spring. rather than it wasn't flourishing, and it needed fencing up because the cattle were eating any new shoots that they could reach and any new plants that might have grown normally on the forest floor.
Mm.
So that's in my head that mental picture is like sort of what happens when
it's pretty grim.
Yeah,
like
the big mammals, we were thinking possums and rats, but like when you're talking cattle, deer, pigs, I know we like to hunt them.
So we've got pigs on the mountain.
Have we got deer? All those animals will mess.
There's not a lot of deer on the mountain. There is a few that come in from outside, and there is work being done to manage that. But yes, the bigger browsing animals, especially, have a huge impact as well. We're really lucky that we don't have big populations of goats and deer.
Do you see any of these animals, Louis, when you're up there?
I don't see any.
You're probably too noisy and they know you're coming.
I see pigs.
Yeah, occasionally we've picked up a deer on our monitoring cameras.
Okay.
But, obviously we have hunters in our community that we really encourage them to just keep on top of those populations and... you can have a small amount of a certain animal there, but once the numbers get too high, we definitely notice the damage, and then it becomes a lot harder for us.
It's an interesting topic too, because I was listening to a talk recently by pest control sort of / hunter, and he was talking about the sweet spot that you can get, that they can exist at well-managed numbers. But that kind of takes the hunters, they need to be very proactive in their management.
They're the apex predator for the ecosystem, basically, aren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, their animals are not going to be in good shape if the numbers are too high. So it's in their own interest to manage those populations and not just think more is better. So, yeah.
I mean, there are stories of people releasing pigs into native bush because knowing that they'll be able to hunt.
That has happened on Kariwe.
Yeah, it happens everywhere. Yeah. It's a funny one, isn't it? Just that balance between conservation and then the hunting community, the farming community.
I suspect there's also people who can't afford a lot of food who know that if they can hunt, then that's some food for the family. I think that's probably in the mix as well.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
I do think that I was saying, listening to these people speak, there was guy Cam Speedy who's equally deep in both worlds of hunting and conservation, and he's a firm believer that there is what he called a sweet spot, like there is a balance that you can have where both can happen.
Yeah, but it's all like every ecosystem, it's reliant on that apex predator, which is the hunting community in this case.
Yeah, they have to be well organized and proactive and actually managing rather than just, leaving it to its own devices.
Yeah, there's probably controversy around that opinion, I imagine.
Probably, on both sides.
Yeah. It can be controversial, but I mean, I'd like to think that any hunters that we're working with or, that are volunteering even and supporting the project, that we're open to have the conversation.
Yeah.
We recognise that the mountain will mean different things to different people, and we're a varied community, and it's our job to represent the community, not just push some kind of exclusive one voice. So we really try and kind of balance that and listen to everyone and not it be a point of contention, but a point of conversation and working together for the best outcomes for our whole community.
So can we see at Maunga Tautere what the ecosystem is supposed to be like? What's the apex predator in the natural world? Is it like the kahu or something? Do we know?
Yeah, well, it would have been just bird predators. Mm. Yeah, so kahu is probably the best we have. Karearea, there's another K word for you.
Yeah.
K, which is a New Zealand falcon. I mean, originally we had larger predatory birds, but they're obviously extinct.
Okay. Mm. Yeah, so I'm just kind of curious, at some point Maunga Tautere should reach a balance level?
Oh, yeah.
And I've got no idea.
They're overflowing on some species already.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like how? Yeah. Like,
well, that's the funny thing. We haven't. We are sort of tailoring these ecosystems, thinking we know best. But I think you're touching on a point that maybe that ecosystem is gonna get. There might be an overpopulation of certain species.
Well, you could. I mean, you could. There could be a situation where a native bird is, there's too many of them, they're actually, it's bad for some particular native plant. I don't know, I'm not trying to, sometimes people use that kind of argument as a criticism, but I'm just curious to know.
Yeah, I think it is a fact.
How it's getting into balance, because ecosystems always try to get into balance, and what that looks like over there.
It's so artificial still, you know, like even though we might say, oh, we've got heaps of kiwi on Mangatut tree, like it's overflowing. What's the problem it's going to create? But the reality is you let a whole bunch of stoats in there and, you know, and possums and everything else, and, you know, you probably revert back within 5 years to what it was 30 years ago or whatever, you know? So it's kind of like it's probably not a real conversation because we still have so many challenges outside those fences. You know, with the fence sanctuaries.
And they're necessary at the moment because
The great thing here is like seeing how with the collective kind of work being done by the community on the mountain and in the backyard trapping kind of, and that is that we are seeing birds come back and we are seeing oi chicks fledge. So even without a fence, we're already doing a lot.
Yeah.
I think that's really encouraging, and I think,
For people who don't know the history, the grey-faced petrel was not successfully breeding here for, we don't know how long, a long time.
Yeah, so it was just hanging by a thread, really.
Yeah, it's significant what's happening with the Karioi project.
It's exciting. Well, that's what keeps us hopeful. Yeah. It's what we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think of when I was a child and going up Karioi, maybe it's in my imagination. I don't think it is, but the forest was a lot quieter. Now when I go up there, I hear, hey, here's another K word, which I hadn't written down, the korimako, which is bell bird, and just an abundance of kereru and tui and metal, the tomtit. Yeah. So
the reason Louis keeps meaning birds that names start with K is because at Trivia Night last night there was a question, name 10 of the 25 native New Zealand birds names start with K. I couldn't believe there were 25, but we got like 9. And most of them I didn't even recognise. I had never seen them before. Well, it's probably time to wrap up, Louis. Have you got something you want to say? Oh, no, I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
About the wind farm, Crystal. Do you have any opinion that's about the potential wind farm out there, 12 nautical miles off the coast? Does that have any effect on grey-faced petrel, the oi?
It could very well do, yeah. Like, I've been thinking about it.
1 or 2 kilometres apart, each of the turbines.
I mean, it is one of those things that you have to explore when you're setting up wind farms, is the impact on birds. And, I mean, I come from a country with lots of windmills, so I know they can be used, you know, and they have them offshore, and they have birds as well. So I think there is a lot of research out there, and I just haven't – I didn't get to that meeting the other night. I was hoping to, but I couldn't. It's a balancing act. I mean, I'm not judging either way at the moment because I haven't done the research yet. But, yes, wind farms can have an impact on bird life, and not just seabirds but also birds migrating. You know, but then there's also the ones coming in and out on a more regular basis. But we also need to look at other ways of generating energy. You know, so there's always going to be the tension, and let's see kind of where that conversation lands.
Yeah, and Louis, did you have anything you wanted to add? I saw you writing and wondered if you your shopping list.
No.
to multitask.
Yeah, yeah.
Just preparing my show for next week.
Oh, okay. No. Well, actually, Louis, what are you doing for the rest of the day?
We've just got more of an operations sort of day today. But we have a meeting
with
the
Department
of Conservation.
Okay.
We're kind of starting to talk about different translocations that might be possible.
bringing species in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's all very...
That's interesting.
It's all very sort of...
Is this breaking news?
No, no. It's just like kind of what can we do to make that possible? Because there is a kind of a call out for, you know, species translocations. And if we can put ourselves in a position to have done the predator control, then...
It kind of ties back into our conversation about Maunga Tautari having numbers getting high and things like that.
Mm.
But...
Yeah. But it's,
and that's good for funders as well to hear that that's happening. I think that would be a significant sign to them. As someone who's always applying to funders, I know you've got to be able to show things to them that there's signs of success.
Yeah, translocations can be they're very detailed, and ultimately translocations happen between hapu. So it's not for us to decide, but what we'd like to do is like make sure that the predator control and the work's been done so it's a possibility.
So it's ready, yeah.
So we're by no means saying this is what's happening. We're just putting ourselves, making decisions so that that can happen well, and if birds come in the future, then we're set up to do that rather than, you know. So we're trying to be proactive and like have the right control in place, and then also just making decisions for our ops plans for next year.
Okay, cool.
So we kind of work hand in hand with Doc, so it's, you know, good to catch up on a regular basis and just swap notes. Yeah.
Awesome. All right, guys, really supportive. Thanks for coming in.
Cool. Thank you.
We've been listening to Crystal and Louis from Karigo Project. We're going to have a little break and a bit of music after this.